Welcome to this recorded session from the 2025 American Craft Sake Festival, hosted by the Sake Brewers Association of North America and Origami Sake in Hot Springs, Arkansas. In this session, you'll hear from the Jones family, Whitney, Jeremy, and Harrison, of Isbell Farms, the family at the forefront of sake rice cultivation in the United States. They'll walk through the journey of sake rice, how it made its way to Arkansas, the challenges of growing sake rice compared to table rice, the innovations they've implemented to increase quality and reduce environmental impact, and what challenges and opportunities still lie ahead for American-grown sake rice. If you enjoy this session and want to stay connected with Savannah for future festivals, conferences, and resources, visit sakeassociation.org to join our newsletter, or follow us at Sake Association on Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn. So, without further ado, let's listen to the Jones family of Isbell Farms' presentation on the rice again. Without further ado, I'll kick it off to our first presenters, the Isbell family. The family, innovation, and sustainability, these three words embody the mission of the Isbell Farms. As a family-operated business, family remains at the heart of everything they do. They believe in trying new things and finding new ways of doing things. Considering themselves entrusted in their farm and land, they aim to care for it the best they know how. They're dedicated to constantly learning and constantly changing for the better. They will be presenting today on
rice.
On rice.
On the rice again.
That's right. On the rice again.
He asked me, "What can I hold? Can I hold this? Because
yes.
I'm super, super short."
Comes
out. Yes. See, and that's better, because I'm really short. If y'all didn't notice. So I was going to do Rice, Rice, Baby, but I remember that Lucas did Rice, Rice, Baby last year. So he said, what do you want to name it? And I was like, on the rice again. So that's where we are. So we're going to talk about the rice again. So that's our, what is that, Willie Nelson? It's Willie Nelson. All right. So we are from Isbell Farms, and some of y'all were able to come to the farm yesterday and visit with us. Who all was on the tour yesterday? Perfect. Yes. So now we're going to dive a little deeper into things that we couldn't speak about in the mill with it running loud and out in the fields and such. So we will go now. We are Isbell Farms. We are first and foremost a family. We are a family-run operation completely from top to bottom. Even the people that work with us there have been there for several years, and they're like family as well. So that is who we are, family Isbell Farms. Now then, everybody, we didn't get to get into this much yesterday, but did anybody like stop and question, why is Yamada Nashiki rice in Arkansas to begin with? Like, how did that even happen? Because that's a stretch, right? That's not something that happens easily. So we have to go all the way back to the late 80s and early 90s to really get to how we got into the Japanese world of rice. And the first thing we grew was not Yamada Nashiki. The first thing we grew was Koshi Hikari. How many of you in here have heard of that variety of rice? And have you tried it? It's absolutely amazing. But how did even that Japanese variety get to Arkansas, to Isbell Farms? Well, here's how it started. It started with a man named Dr. Shoichi Ito. He is a friend of my dad's, and actually they met spontaneously at a rice meeting. In what year, Daddy? I asked Daddy to speak, but he said I could do 87. So I might have to have him fill some things in for me. So in 1987, you went to the RTWG, correct? And that's a rice technical working group where all of the PhDs come to present their papers on their research. But it was uncommon for a farmer to be present at these things. A lot of these people had never seen their work, that a farmer growing anything in the field. So they had seen their work in the research labs, but not seen how it went down to the farmer. So they were extremely excited to get to speak with a farmer. Also, my dad is an avid ping pong player, and I just like to go on the record as saying that I've never beat him. I've beat almost everybody else, but I've never beat my dad. But this particular night, he did lose, and I think he was probably sulking just a little bit. So he's leaning back against the wall, and there was a nice Japanese gentleman standing there beside him as he sulked after losing his game, because he doesn't like to lose ping pong. Shoichi walked up, and he didn't speak great English, and so nobody was really bringing him into the conversation. So my dad's a very kind Southern man, and he began to engage Shoichi in some conversation. And of course, if you're at a rice technical working group, what are you gonna talk about? You're gonna talk about rice. And so my dad says, hey, what's the best rice in Japan? And he says, Koshi Hikari. But it can only be grown in what?
There's your little.
Yes, it can only be grown in Japan. Now, what's the difference in rice? We have long grain, medium grain, short grain. The Koshi comes in the short grain variety. And that's not something that's commonly grown in Arkansas. But my dad was like, why couldn't it grow? Now, here's the thing. We'll talk about this in a minute. Here he is. He's actually here, too. I call him the Pawpaw because it's not, I don't feel like we should call him the godfather of sake rice, and the grandkids call him Pawpaw. So I like to refer to him as the Pawpaw of sake rice. He likes that term, too. He likes it a lot. So the Pawpaw of sake rice, and I like to say, you know, years ago, we got a call from Takara. And they asked, did we have Yamada Nishiki? And we did have it in stock. So he doesn't like for me to give him this much credit, but I feel like sake in the United States wouldn't be what it is today if it hadn't been for him pioneering that idea and bringing these things to the United States. So I call him the pawpaw of sake rice. But let's talk about why we were able to grow it in Arkansas. We are on the same latitude as Hyogo, Japan. And those kind of things do matter when it comes to producing rice. So let's just use for an example, Thai jasmine. It really won't grow in Arkansas. It won't flower. There are different places in the world that rice won't flower and pollinate and grow. So it was a, can we do this? Because we're on the same latitude as Hyogo, Japan. Can we grow this rice? And we absolutely did. And it was so good, the koshi was so good that it won taste tests and all the things. And we had Japanese visitors. Can you go back to that slide with the bag with the picture?
Yeah.
This one right here. So this is our family in cartoon form. So when Koshi came to Arkansas, the Japanese world loved that. And they visited us like crazy. We had tour buses like yesterday, limousines, helicopters, all the things. And they also created this bag in Japan. This was our rice in Japan. And it was at Family Mart. And they gave away a trip to Arkansas. So if you bought a bag of rice, you were entered into a contest and you got to come to Humnoak, Arkansas. And I always say, but y'all got to experience this yesterday. What does it feel like to like think you're going somewhere and get off a bus in the middle of a rice field? They came all the way from Japan to see that. And that whole story, just a clip of that story, is how we were able to have Japanese rice in Arkansas. And that koshi eventually led to us having other Japanese varietals. And in that was Yamada Nishiki, Omachi, Goyakumangoku, Watari Bune. So that is why Isabel Farms has Japanese rice in Arkansas. And now we're going to let Jeremy talk about how the climate is affecting the things that we're doing now.
This is USDA Rice Farmer of the Year 2023.
Oh, yeah!
Matt, you can go get something to drink. I'll slip you that
later. I actually forgot, I got so busy, we were trying to get the audio to work. I forgot to introduce this. I'm Whitney. I'm Chris and Judy's daughter. This is my son, Harrison. This is my husband, Jeremy. And it says Isabel Farms. Our last name is actually Jones. We're speaking for Isabel Farms today. So we're a whole family operation, but this is my husband.
Yep. And I'm proud to be here today. Thank you. Thank you for having me. I've been on the farm about 30 years. I brought a little Jones to the Isabel Farms, but I'm proud to be part of the Isabel family for sure. So why does this...
Go ahead for the next one.
Yeah, she said, why does this matter? We're talking about the challenges that we have growing the Japanese rice, but it's all rice, really, that we're having challenges growing right now. How is the climate affecting things? Well, what we see, it seems like to us, just from this anecdotal, you know, data and observation, that our extremes are becoming more extreme. And so that's how it's really starting to affect us. When we have a drought, it seems like the droughts last longer, the temperatures are hotter. When we have a flood every year, it seems like we say, man, we've never seen the water quite this high before. Or we say, we hear on the news, we're having a generational type of weather event, a generational type of flood, a 100-year flood. And I've had conversations in the last couple of days about this with some of you, like, isn't it seem like we're having one of these generational floods every year, every other year? And that's what we see on the farm. And it does affect how we do things. We're having to make changes on the farm to be able to survive in those types of events. So we have a timeline here. Whitney was asking me this week when we were kind of putting this together, just in my memory, when this all kind of started, when we see this. Now, Chris is back there. He's got more experience than me because he's got a few years on me. So he's seen some of this further back. But what I remember is we really started to see a shift around 2009. We had our first big flood during the growing season. We have high water in the wintertime. You know, it's normal to have a lot more rainfall that time of the year. But that's when we really started to see it in my experience, in my career, is about that mid, you know, about 2009. And 2011, we had three major floods. 2012, had one in 17, 18, 19. And in 21, we had the most devastating. We had a flood of nearly 20 inches of rain in about 3 days, through right through the drainage that comes through the farm. If those of you that were on the bus yesterday saw how high the water was on the highway that runs through the farm, we don't see that often, but we're seeing it more and more often now. So that seems to have started then. In 2021, we had a flood in June when the rice was, some of it was at mid-season. It was a devastating flood. We estimate about 40% of our yield, you know, total that year. And here in 2025, we're presently in a flood. About half the crop is planted. About half of that is still underwater. And the acres that aren't planted are completely inundated for the most part. So planting is going to be delayed probably until sometime in May. I say all that to say that those things do happen, but they're not unprecedented, but they seem to be happening more and more and more frequently, and that's a concern. So what are we seeing kind of from climate change? Like I said, the droughts, the floods. Obviously, the flood presents the problem of, you know, planting and keeping the seedlings happy when they're young. But what we're also seeing is how it's changing the rice. Last year we noticed that we had a really, really dry, hot summer, kind of a drought through the middle of the summer, when a lot of the rice was pollinating. And so that affected milling yields all across the Mid-South. We have some of the lowest milling yields that we've seen in a generation in all types of rice, whether it's sake rice, long grain, medium, whatever. We also noticed in the sake rice, with some analysis that we did, that the things like gel temp differences appeared that we didn't expect. And so we were glad we had that analysis done. Some of the brewers noticed, you know, differences in steaming times and cooking times and things like that. So it's those are things that we think the climate has something to do with. So what are we going to do about it? Well, how do we, you know, we can't change the weather. We can't change the climate, obviously. So how we're trying to adapt is spreading the planting dates. I think that's on this slide. Planting the sake rice over different types of the farm. We typically have a heavy clay soil on the farm, but we do have some variation. It goes from a more loamy type of soil to really heavy clay. So we're experimenting with putting the sake rice on different parts of the farm to try to see if we can make a difference there. Microclimate kind of thing is in our, you know, we have some fields that have trees all the way around. So maybe nighttime temperatures are a little bit different there than on the, you know, over where it's, there are no trees and you have a different wind, a direction, or things like that. So spreading the plant date out, that's a big thing. You know, if we can plant early, obviously the rice is going to be harvested earlier, but that's going to cause it to pollinate at a different time than if it's planted later. So we're trying to spread those planting dates out, try to plant some early, some mid, some late, and then try to analyze what we're getting out of that, and constantly looking for ways to improve that and running that analysis year after year so that we can provide the best rice that we possibly can. So you want me to talk about this too? So what are we doing on our farm to try to help the climate? I mean, when I said we can't control it, we can't, but we can do our part to try to change and adapt and make the planet you know, better. So here's what a few things that we're doing. We've been working with the University of Arkansas and Arkansas State and Arkansas Research Service for several years on projects to try to mitigate things like greenhouse gases that come off of rice fields. Rice is a grown typically in Arkansas in a flooded condition through the growing season, and that produces methane. And methane is a big greenhouse gas. We talked a lot about this, I think, last year in the series as well. So what we've done is installed these eddy flow covariance towers on two fields in the, we didn't, the researchers did this, but we just kind of offered the in-kind support that they need. And they're measuring methane coming off of two fields in real time, and we change practices on those fields year to year based on their request. Using mostly alternate wetting and drying. So instead of a flooded condition, allowing the fields to dry down to an aerobic, you know, condition before we reflood. And we've seen over about 10 years of data that we're mitigating methane coming off of the field with AWD by about 60 to 65%, and even higher in some cases. So that's one thing we're doing. We are a zero grade farm. Our actual farm name we go by Isbell Farms, but we are actually zero grade farms. And what that simply means is that every field that we farm rice on has been leveled as flat as this floor. So if there's an inch of water on one corner, there's an inch of water all over the field. And what we've learned, and this was, we did this because I didn't do this. Mr. Chris and his father, Leroy, really were pioneers in this technology. They did it because they didn't want to pull these contour levees every year and have to walk them with a shovel and a spillway over their back and have your hands down in snakes and mosquitoes and the whole thing. So they, and I'm not saying this because I think he's lazy at all, but he said this to me years ago, that that necessity is not always just, let's see, how do you say it? It's not just necessity that's the mother of invention. Laziness can also be the mother of invention. So, zero grade was invented for that reason too. But what we learned over the years is it uses a tremendously less amount of water than cascade levee farming in rice. So worldwide, sources say that it takes about 20 cups of water to produce 100 grains of rice. In the United States, it's about 12. And at Isbell Farms, we figure we're using about 5 cups of water to produce 100 grains of rice. So way below the national and the world average on that.
We don't have any volume on this next video, so you're going to have to narrate it.
Oh, okay.
Oh. Oh.
Oh, I'll mute it.
Okay, so this is.
I don't think it's even gonna play.
Okay, no.
You gonna play? This is an example of
being terrible.
It's not gonna work. It's okay. You can just play it.
All right. So this was an example here. Someone was showing, I believe, of like a contour levee field versus a zero grade rice field, and you saw a lot. If you were at the farm yesterday, you saw a lot of zero grade rice fields, but. This is
a video
of the water going out on the field. I think I had my camera turned upside down. I was proud of that one.
That's a good representation of the flatness of the field. That's how the water will actually spread right across, yeah, even 80 acres, you know. So it's flat.
And I didn't really look at these videos very close, so I don't know what I was narrating.
Well, it doesn't really matter when they don't work.
Okay. But anyway, so those are a few things that we're doing. That's not all, you know, that we're doing, but the we do things very strange at Isbell Farms. We get a lot of questions about. There's one video I think that's with the combines running, and we start in the center of the field, and we work our way out in a spiral pattern, and people are fascinated by that. I think since Google Earth and aerial photography and drones, you know, people see those shots. Even in the wintertime, you look at those fields and you see these spirals and you think, but there's aliens or crop circles, you know, what's going on here? But again, that's something that we learned over the years and in before my time. I'm not taking any credit for that. But that's a very efficient way to harvest a field because you go to the center and you start working your way out. It does a few things. It allows your bank out carts to come into the field and unload the combine anywhere in the field and exit the field. It also allows wildlife to escape to the edges of the field and move out. And there's a lot of wildlife that take refuge in those fields. So little strange things like that kind of set us apart. But we're very interested in being as innovative as we possibly can. And we're always looking for ways to be more innovative. So if you have, you know, ideas or questions about that, don't hesitate to ask. We might not be able to do it, but we're always willing to entertain and, you know, and try to innovate any way we can. So Harrison, I think, is going to talk a little bit more about.
I don't know what I'm talking about, to be honest with you. I didn't really look over the slides.
I try so hard, y'all. Y'all know what it's like to manage these two people?
She didn't have them completed until a few days ago, so give me some credit. All right. So I think
I think just talk.
Okay, this is some stuff that Nick asked us to talk about. So just talking about kind of the current situation and the trade wars and stuff. Obviously, we're positioned pretty well, I guess, to handle some of those things. And in some cases, where we're, you know, shipping rice and have customers in other countries, that's going to affect things. But, you know, we wanted to assure you that we're, you know, keeping an eye on things and watching those things and you know, doing everything we can. Not to mention that we've, you know, set our business up in a way that allows us to handle each customer individually and try to meet your needs where you're at. So, you know, we're keeping an eye on those things and making sure we're doing what we can to mitigate extra costs and things like that. So these are varieties that we currently offer in our sake rice lineup. Yamada Nishiki, obviously, is the main one that we're growing. Omachi and then Titan. Those are the ones that we have available pretty much all the time that we're, you know, we're able to, if you send us an email and reach out, we can get you those. And then we have these varieties in cold storage that we can grow, but we need to know how much we need before we grow it. So the issue is we can't take, we have large fields. So you can't just take a small plot and plant one variety and store it separately and mill it separately and handle it separately just for one small brewery necessarily. We would love to, but it's just not really in the cards. So if one of these varieties is interesting to you, if you want to start making a sake with it, or you want to group up with three or four brewers and start making a sake with this, you know, you can reach out to us. We can make up a contract. We can plant 10, 15, 20, 30, 100 acres, whatever, and store that, dry that, mill that for you. And we love to branch out and try new things and try new varieties. But those are the reasons that we're only growing those three currently. It's just a challenge to move past that. Okay, this is what I was told I was talking about this morning that she didn't tell me.
I didn't get this till last night.
So we did send some Goyakumongo Ku to Todd Bellamy at Far the Star Sake this year. He bought some and brewed with it. And I'll just let you read off the screen what he had to say, because I think he just called yesterday and said this. But this is what he's seeing out of that. And then obviously, if you're interested in how that worked, you could reach out to Todd and then, you know, work with us to get you some of that or anything else that was listed up there. So this is all Todd notes? Todd
mm-hmm.
Okay. So this is what, you know, this is a good way to have a contact that knows, you know, how this performed, and that would, you know, let you reach out and kind of figure out if you wanted that, and then reach out to us and we can grow some more of it. Okay, so we talked about the farm, we talked about all that stuff. So about a year and a half ago, we moved the mill that Nick was running in Minnesota at Moto E. And we bought that, moved it to Arkansas. Some of you saw it yesterday. We had lunch there. We've been working to set that up and get that up and running for the past year and a half, but we have been operating for that long. So that was kind of the next step in our vertical integration process from where we're at. We started with Japanese rice. We transitioned into sake rice. Once we did that, we had to find a way to mill it. Blake Richardson and Nick Lowry in Minnesota were the best fit at that time. And then as our demand grew, we realized that we needed to purchase some equipment and move into that so that we weren't shipping rice across the country to get it to you guys, to get it to brewers and things like that. So that was the logical next step and the part that we've been working on for the past few years. What am I supposed to talk about on this?
You made it.
No, I got it. So some of you have voiced some concerns about demand and how we're growing and those types of things. Can you get rice still? Can we still supply you? Those types of things. And yes, you know, we do have larger breweries that are coming on board in the United States, Japanese owned and otherwise. And so the demand is larger, which is good from a business perspective, but can be scary for, you know, people who are ordering less. And, you know, we just want you to know that is at the forefront of our mind. We have you guys in our, you know, in our plan, and we're not going to leave some brewer out that we're already working with for a larger brewery. That's just not part of our business model. Now, that being said, if you are a smaller brewery and you're not a customer with us and you want to be, then, you know, reaching out and making sure that we have that product ahead of time is always a good plan, because, you know, planning ahead is a big deal with what we're doing as far as how many acres we plant and what we actually have on hand at the time.
You studied well, didn't you?
Oh, I studied so good. So this is a project that the guild's working on, that Lucas is working on, and the association, trying to get some parameters and some analysis done on rice so that you guys can know exactly what you're dealing with each year and each crop, each variety, those types of things. And we just want you to know that we're working on that. And we're more than willing to give and provide and work on all the information that we can. But that's a long process. And just like Dad was talking about, soil types and microclimates and where we plant rice, we want to know how that affects things. We want to know what plant dates affect things, how the gel temps and the starch content and the shimpaku and all that stuff changes. So obviously, since it's a full year-long process, it's really hard to gather a bunch of data at once. But we're certainly doing that as we plant and taking notes and trying to learn from that and get the information out there so that you know every year what you're dealing with. Because this year we did notice a difference. And we think we can attribute that to the summer temperatures, which is something that we can't control, but we might be able to plant it earlier or plant it later to avoid some of those things that you don't want to see. So that's something that we're keeping in mind all the time.
Okay.
Are you talking now?
I don't know. Yeah,
go for it.
I don't know.
Okay. Are you done?
Yeah.
This is Kel. We are fly by the seat of our pants kind of family.
I didn't know what I was talking about.
I have been working on this, but we have also been dealing with flood. Okay.
You made me talk about the thing I didn't know about.
Yeah. You did so good, though. We want to say this, that we do grow the rice, and we enjoy doing that, but it wouldn't be amazing without you, the brewer. And so what we do for you so that you're able to make some amazing sake. So we just have rice. Y'all make it into something magical. And we want to thank each and every one of you for doing that.
And we want to have enough, and we want to have what everybody wants.
Yes.
We just have to know
in advance
so that we can plan for you. Because it's not a call now and get exactly what you need all the time.
It takes a year. At least.
And that's not because we don't want it to be.
It's just
because that's the way it is.
We just talked about, we have a small planting season. It sits out there for 130 days. We can't just grow it any time.
Yep, exactly.
So, y'all, I put this together at the end just for some fun stuff, but I don't know if they're going to play. We talked yesterday when we were on the farm about some different things. I want to see if it's going to play. So sometimes we actually do fly the rice in with an airplane. This has really cool audio, but it's not going to work. But we're going to see the video. So we do this when we've had floods or we need to be able to get in there. What, you can watch the seed fall.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
wow. Yeah, that's a super cool video.
Should be standing under it. It's really fun.
Yeah.
Yes, it's really fun. And he flies super low right over you. We do that on some varieties. You can speak more while we fly it in.
So there's a lot of what we grow. It depends on the year and the percentages of sake rice and what we grow. But it depends on the variety a lot, how we'll plant it, as well as the weather conditions at the time, that we're facing. But for something like a hybrid variety, a long grain that we do grow a lot of, the seeding rates and the specificity that you have to plant that at doesn't really allow to do it with an airplane like that, because there's a lot of carryover. You're losing some seed. You're not placing it exactly where you want it. With a more conventional variety or something that the seed is not as expensive or, that you have more of on hand, you can do something like this where you spread it with a plane. And that, limits your tractor passes. Obviously, you don't have to have the field dry. You can still have it flooded. So even in a scenario like we're in now, we could wait till the water goes down a bit and then water seed some rice directly into that. And we have done that before in the past. And then if you want to pinpoint and plant a more specific seeding rate, more specific poundage, then we'll do that with a drill and a more precision tool.
Okay, the next video is planting with a drill. Now, this is the smaller drill that we talked about. How wide is the big drill?
42.5.
42.5. So this is the smaller one. It's not going to play, is it? Are you hooked up to good? There it goes. Okay, so this would be a small drill plant. And it has really cool music to it and Harrison talking and explaining it.
Thank God it won't
Here,
play.
We're going to let him. Are you going to explain it?
Huh? I mean, I can.
You can narrate it.
So, I mean, this is actually really small. This is us planting him out in the Shiki. This is a small drill that sometimes we'll use to plant one or two fields. But what we do is you calibrate these to plant the exact seeding rate that you want to plant, fill it up, go out there, and it's got a blade that cuts into the ground, opens the ground up, lays the seeds in there, and then a packing wheel that comes back over and covers that up. The larger version of that is 42.5 feet. That's what we run. It's an air seeder. So it has a fan, a hydraulic fan system with hoses that go to each individual planting unit, and that seed's metered out very precisely and then forced out to each individual unit by the air. And that's how we plant most of everything that we have.
That may be, I don't think I have a video of that.
Of the?
I don't think I have, I just didn't add it. See if the next one, I can't see it. So this would be an aerial view, I think, of our planting. It may not, yes. This is the same thing, but this is just some drone footage where you can get a really good idea of what the field looks like from the, it's going to go above it in a second.
We intended for you to see this in person.
Yes, that's what it looks like from
the weather did not.
Yeah, we were hoping we'd be able to plant while you were there and you could see it, but we didn't make it. So that, we usually plant in March, well, we planted late March, early April, early May. After June, we begin to lose yield and quality. So we try not to plant after June if we don't have to.
Within the 1st of April to the middle of May would be your ideal planting time. Doesn't ever work that way, but it's...
And then this is what it looks like when it's green. And it has really cool bird and bug noises, and y'all don't get to hear that. So Harrison's going to make those for you now.
Chirp, 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 chirp. Come on, Lucas. Chirp, 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 chirp.
It's very not quite that play.
It's
but this
not
is what
play.
The rice looks like when it's green. It's beautiful, and the mosquitoes are intense.
There it goes.
There. No, it's going to lock up. Oh, yeah, I tried. Okay, Harrison, you can talk about the stages of rice next.
What about it?
It's how it grows.
So rice is a grass. So it grows a lot like the grass in your yard. It likes a lot of the same things, except it likes a flood or most of the time. It likes a saturated environment, at least. So we'll plant, like I say, a specific seeding rate depending on the variety. And then once that comes up, it'll be a single seedling, which would look like this. And then as it starts to get older, it does what we call tillering.
We talked about this yesterday. I know those of y'all that were on the tour, I was showing you the one little baby Yamada.
Right.
And I said it was going to spread out and make a big plant.
Yeah, and a lot of you were saying, you know, the plants look sporadic. And when it's young, it will. It'll look more like you can see a lot of the dirt. As it gets older, it starts to spread. It does what we call tillering, where it'll actually put out more roots along the ground and stick out more shoots. And each of those will have a panicle, which will have a number of grains on each one. So you can see in this, you see the single seedling. Each of those green sprouts that you see came from an individual seed in this scenario. And then this whole plant right here came from one of those as well. So as the growing season goes on and as it starts to grow, it'll spread out and fill in that field and become thicker. And obviously increase your yield and make those things better. So it looks thin, it looks sporadic, but as the growing season goes on, and we pinpoint that spread so that we get a better yield and it does what it's supposed to do throughout the year, because different varieties tiller more or less, and we plan on that. You know, we know what they're gonna do. Here's a, I don't know if this will play.
See.
This is a good example of what he was talking about, where we cut in a circle. So we'll start there in the center, where you see that little green, that green patch, and then work our way all the way out until we hit the corners, and then just knock out the corners quickly. That's a super efficient way to harvest that we've learned. That allows us to actually catch the combines with the grain carts while they're moving. So once the combine opens the center of the field and starts to go in that circle, they never stop. You can see, you know, I'm moving in this tractor and he's moving in this combine, and nobody has to stop. He never has to stop harvesting. So it's a constant, efficient thing. We have two grain carts. Once one's full, it goes out and dumps on a truck. The other guy comes in, takes care of the combines while you're gone. You come back and nobody ever quits. So when you're going, and there's no downtime.
Then like the mod is next. You can stand up. You have it.
I'm good. Yeah, so this is a video of us cutting Yamada.
You were asking yesterday when I said it fell over.
Yeah,
somebody asked me what I meant when I said it lodges, it falls over. This is what it looks like.
So this is a prime example You can see there's actually some standing rice in the background there. That's uncommon. This field was mostly standing, and we were jumping for joy when we got to harvest it because it was so much easier than what we were used to. But this right here, this spot in front of the header there, is the prime example of what Yamada does best. It falls over, it mangles together, it kind of tangles, and makes a mat, and it's extremely difficult to pick up with traditional machinery.
So this is why it's so expensive.
it's a gigantic part of why it's so expensive. I told this at the last talk we did, but we had 400 acres of Yamada this year. Over half of it actually stood up like this field did. The weather conditions just happened to be pretty good. We had one field that did not. It went down terribly and matted together, tangled. That field was 66 acres. It took us 4 days to harvest that field with two machines. Traditionally, at like long grain or something, some hybrid variety, it would take us 4 or 5 hours to cut. So we're talking about an extreme increase in fuel, time, money, everything.
Nerves.
So, yeah, nerves. That's a long, long day, too. Dad, me and Dad can tell you.
Daddy usually cuts the Yamada because he likes to pick it up and treat it gently and do all the things, and so that's kind of his thing. And he called me one day and he said, "I quit." And I said, "What?" And I said, "Did you finish that field?" And he said, "No, I quit." And I said, "Daddy, that rice is sold. Get your butt back on the combine. Go get some more of that rice."
I got on it the next day while he was doing something else. He called and said, "Do you want to get off of that?" And I said, "I don't care." And he said, "All right, don't. I'm going home."
So this is some research that my dad did that he likes to talk about. And so I put this slide in there. So we take what we do very seriously. We do provide sake rice for our brewers, and that's very important. But we also take into consideration that we are feeding the world. Rice is about 20% of the calories consumed across the world in a given day. So it's a large thing that needs to be on the market, and we take that extremely seriously. And we say, if you ask my dad, what does he do for a living? And he says, "I feed people. I feed the world." And so that's what we do, and that's what we take very seriously. And this is how much we can do on our farm. According to Google, 1 pound of brown rice feeds 7 people. One of our grain bins, let's see, it's out of order. Golly.
PowerPoint, I didn't do this.
PowerPoint switched my stuff. So I did not put it in this order. So let's one do combine. One combine load feeds 75,000 people. Go over there. And then one grain cart load feeds 150,000. Truck load 300,000. And our bins 8.4 million. And we have enough to feed 92.4 million people one meal of rice. So that's a lot. We take that very seriously. We also take the fact that our land needs to be passed down generation to generation very seriously. So our sustainability practices are more than one reason. We do it to take care of the land. We do it to have things to pass down, to produce the best rice that we can. So it's all in there.
And the only cost of today's presentation is a free follow on all social media platforms.
Yes, all across news today. So we're leaving enough time. We got about 10 minutes left, and we wanted to take questions if you have any. So we'll take, because I know yesterday it was very hard to hear. So if you have any questions for us now, we'd like to open up the floor.
How much of that rice do you have in storage of that
Gongyo? So I think that I just shipped out the last.
I don't believe we have enough to sell, but we do have enough to grow.
I think that two seats down from you is who got the last bit of that.
I don't need like a big, I need like a very small, like,
damn it, Justin.
I think Justin just cleaned us out on that. I don't think we even have 100 pounds left of the Watarin or the Goyak right now. You might have to take up Justin. Yeah,
Calling him out, poor guy.
But yes, we don't have any of that right now. But if that is a large interest among the brewers, we are willing to put some in. So if that's something that you want to do after,
I was saying before, I think a good way to go about that may be to talk to other brewers who want to use it and decide how much you could use and then let us know. And then, you know, we can write up something or even not necessarily even write up a contract. But as long as we know we can sell you a certain volume to make it worth our time and effort to grow it, so that we're not losing money, basically, We're absolutely willing to do that. That's just the hump you have to get over to get
there.
We
can't put this rice on the regular rice market. So this isn't something.
It's either sake rice or dog food, basically. So that's a really fine line to.
Wow. That's the way to put it right there.
It's true.
That's
your son right there. Why did you let me make the slides?
Because you didn't do it. Are there any other questions?
He's not wrong, though. It is a premium product, but if it can't be used for that use, then there's nobody else is interested in
not
it.
Not locally, anyway. Not without a lot of hoops to jump through to get it where it would need to go. In our local market, we're the only one that's in this special, market. So that's a difficult hoop.
With the right conditions, how long can you store rice?
Okay, you take this. You take the question. Yeah. Stand up.
No, Dad. That's a Dad question.
So rough rice will store like on farm storage for, depending on how it's treated. Up to 3 years. You don't want to store it for 3 years, but up to 3 years, I would say. Two is not uncommon. You have to really be careful how it's treated. And then once it's milled, it can be put in cold storage and be stored for another 2 years probably. But those are about the limits on it. You start on-farm storage, depending on how. If you can chill the grain, and I didn't talk about really how we store grain, but we do store most of the grain that we harvest to store on and dry it on the farm in our on-farm storage. And we have a computer system with moisture and temperature cables that give us readings in real time of what the grain is doing, what the temperature is, what the moisture is. And if we can pump in some cold air in the wintertime and really chill that grain down, you can chill it down in the where it's below 40 degrees in internal temperature inside the bin. And if you can lock it down there and seal everything up, it will stay cold in there for months and months and months. And that keeps you from having insect problems and spoilage that way. But if it's not kept cool, it won't last nearly that long. So.
Nick, a question.
Yeah. So now that you're have vertically integrated and you're milling as well, do you have channels that you're moving your byproducts from the milling operation, whether it be the flour or the broken grains?
Yeah, so that's been our obviously our number one focus was to learn all the secrets you knew about the mill and how to run that and how to get the product that we wanted out of it. So once we got the mill up and running, it took several months to get our feet under us as far as how to most efficiently operate all the machinery as well as get the best quality product. And after we did that, we started to realize we have flour, we have broken grains, and we don't want to just be selling those for animal food or waste. So we don't have a full usage for them yet, but what we're doing is I've got several beer brewers who are using the flour and the broken grains to make things like rice lagers and pilsners. That would be my preference as far as moving forward. That's what we want to do is, you have a product that's not really as appealing to you guys for sake, but that can be super appealing for beer brewing. So you've got one side's making a great beverage and the other side's making a great beverage too. And so you're getting quality products on both sides. That's the goal.
So that you can drink rice.
Yeah, so that you can drink rice. But that is that's an ongoing process. I'm constantly reaching out to beer breweries and things like that. And if any of you guys are interested in using, you got it. Some rice flour and brokens and understanding how to better use those for beer brewing. I've done some work with Scott LaFontaine at the University of Arkansas as far as like analysis and figuring out the best ways to use that, as well as what's different about sake rice flour and brokens as opposed to your traditional rice products that are used in beer brewing. There's some beneficial differences for sake rice. So that's where we're trying to go with that.
And you'll get to try some of that tonight. Moody Brews is going to be here.
Moody Brews will be at the festival tonight, and their pilsner is made with a majority of rice flour.
And named after one of our fields, too.
Yeah, so
if you get a chance to try the new ground.
You mentioned that the University of Arkansas mentioned that there's more benefits using sake rice and beer, what are those benefits?
So the things that we found is I'll reach out to a beer brewer and they'll say, well, we can't steam it to the right temperature. We can't gelatinize it. We can't use it because of that. What we found is that it can be added directly into the mash without extra cooking steps and things like that. So it takes out the need for extra equipment. Brewers can buy it directly from us and use it on their system. You know, there might be some challenges to figuring out how to use it a little differently, but you can use it on a traditional system without having to have a cooker, a steamer, and all those types of things to prep it before you brew with it. So that's a big benefit when I'm not having to tell somebody that they have to buy a bunch of equipment to use my product, as opposed to just, you know, this is how you use it, but you can use it on what you have. That's what we found so far. Even the broken grains, flour and the broken grains, are both being able to use that way.
Your protein is different too. Your levels of protein. So it's a higher starch content because they're getting it at 90 and milling it from there, as opposed to the main mill where you'd have it pretty much from ground rice through. So
there's no brand in it or anything like that. So it's a totally different product than what you're getting from a traditional rice mill's flour. Yeah. Absolutely. You're farther down into the grain, so you're getting a totally different product. It's more like cornstarch almost. Mm-hmm. The texture of it is totally different. So that's what we've been seeing, that it's easier to use in that way.
Jeremy showed a slide that showed the kind of globally the latitude comparing Arkansas mm-hmm. to a year ago. And in terms of the different soil types on your farm, you mentioned heavy clay to loam. Have you done any research to kind of see what they do in Hyogo in terms of preferred soil types to maximize quality with your Yamada?
That would actually be a question I think Chris would probably better equipped to answer than me. Not that I'm aware. I mean, I'm not sure what the soil type is there. Chris, do you want to talk about that?
More clay.
More clay? So
similar to ours, or?
Yeah. Yes, it's extremely similar to ours.
They're mountainous, and so they've got the different climates. I mean, we try to adjust our planting day to mimic that as much as possible. Nighttime temperature.
We have spoken with several farmers from Japan and kind of talked through some of those things, and we would like to do some more. I'd like to go over there and see, but. Yeah, that's a consideration for sure.
And we're not trying to say that we're like identical to Hyogo. That's kind of the point is, when you look at the globe, our latitude is very similar. So in the initial thinking, we're like, why wouldn't this work here? I mean, their elevation is different. You know, they are more mountainous. Their soil type's going to be somewhat different. But it was just interesting to us that, hey, we're right there. Let's try this, and it's been successful.
Well,
that was the main point.
And the things that we tend to believe affect, like Shimpaku and quality, are climate mostly, the soil type a little bit, and that's what we're playing with. But since we do have that pretty much same exact climate, we feel that helps the quality, and it puts us on the same similar level of the quality of sake rice that they're producing over there.
I can put you all in contact with the brewery that I worked at.
That'll be cool. Absolutely.
Perfect.
We're always looking to learn something new. And
we never go on a vacation that we don't go visit a beer brewery and a sake brewery. We always do that as well. We try to, when we're in your areas, we try to combine and say hi.
Absolutely.
We can. I think we're out of time. We're right at 10 o'clock. Did anybody have any quick questions before we go? I just wanted to say thank you again to you, the brewers, and the people that are enthusiastic about sake. We couldn't do this without you. We were just a rice farm in Arkansas, and everybody around us just grows rice normal in Arkansas. So we get to be cool and hip and fun and get to come to things like this with y'all, and we want to thank you for that, because without y'all making good things out of our rice, we wouldn't be here today. So
this is one of our favorite events of the year, because we get to see that. And all the way through, that's super cool.
We like to get to know you. We like to do business. We always do business at the table, at the kitchen table. So if you've ever been to our farm, we probably brought you to the kitchen table and fed you lunch. And
if you'd like to book your lunch tour, talk to Judy in the back.
my mom is here, and you will never visit the farm that she will not cook you lunch. I know there's a lot of people in here that have probably eaten at her table. That's the way we like to do things. We like to be friends and family, and so that's what we want to be with y'all. And so. We thank you. very much. Yeah. And we are going to bug out because we have to go to the Cherry Blossom Festival next. So we're not, we would love to stay and hear the speakers, but stop by our table.
Thanks for listening to this session from the 2025 American Craft Sake Festival. We had a great time, and we hope you learned something new. To stay connected with the Sake Brewers Association of North America and be the first to hear about future events and resources, visit sakeassociation.org to join our newsletter, or follow us at Sake Association on Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn. Thanks.